This week, black gold continued its skyward trajectory, finishing at the best point in almost a year on the continued commodities sector rally. Welcome back to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Chris Waltzek here with another muy grande size show. Investors were unnerved yet again by more rhetoric from Fed policymakers who've changed their minds, it seems, on rate hikes. According to the April FOMC meeting minutes released on Wednesday, our officials could raise rates one or even two more times this year. But investors aren't so sure. The upcoming rate meeting in June now shows low odds of a rate hike. Not until July or later in the year could we see 75 basis points. Joining me with their perspective on the markets, Peter Grandich. He shares his positive comments on the precious metals, crude oil, and stocks. He's looking for $1,400, even $1,500 an ounce gold in 2016. He expects QE4 or some other alternative plans from our officials to keep the shaky house of cards together. Then top Wall Street technician Ralph Acampora of Altera Wealth Management returns to the show with his overview of key support levels in the markets. He says gold and silver have seen their lows. That's right, the Wall Street pundit thinks gold and silver will move higher this year. And he also expects stocks to move higher as investors shy away from the Eurozone and other parts of the world in favor of U.S. equities. And he's also a big fan of black gold, with its sights set on $60 or maybe even $65 a barrel. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies continued to hover over the precious metals this week for the third week running. Gold ended at $1,252 an ounce, off just 21, about 1.5% by Friday. Silver gave back only 60 cents, about 3.5% for the week, finishing at $1,653 an ounce. The precious metals XAU share shed about 1.5 points, 1.7%, ending at 85, still higher for the year by close to 100%. West Texas Intermediate crude added $1.40 per barrel, nearly 3%, closing just under 48, holding above support now for 3 weeks, and the best close in over 7 months. A 50% rebound retracement could lead this sector higher by as high as 60 to 65% if bulls can overcome that $50 resistance point. Shares in oil and gas companies blasted higher, the best performing sector this week in the S&P 500, thanks in no small part to the rebound rally in crude. Well, the yellow metal remains higher by about 15% for the year, topping a 15-month high recently, the best advance in years on the much lower greenback. Still, the dollar has rallied over the last 3 weeks on growing concerns of another rate hike, perhaps in 2016. Fed officials called for at least two more, the New York Fed President William Dudley, as he said on Thursday, and Richmond Fed President Jeffrey Lacker agreed with his comments that we could see one in June to July. Contrary to the Fed's rhetoric, traders just not buying it. As mentioned earlier, the current Fed funds futures indicates only a quarter rate point hike, maybe by July. Meanwhile, holdings in gold-backed exchange-traded products continues to soar, with 6 metric tons added this week despite a little sluggishness in the market. That's the highest since December of 2013, according to a Bloomberg report. Precious metals, bottom line. The incredible precious metals rally paused a bit this week, which is viewed again as a pause that could refresh. Most of our pundits are still looking for 1,400, maybe even 1,500 gold by the end of the year, and silver north of $20. Moving on to the Wall Street report, partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York Exchange. Profit taking continued for the fourth consecutive week. In the blue chips, the Dow Jones shed 34 points, finishing near the break-even point at 17,535. However, the S&P 500 bucked the trend, picking up 6, about a quarter percentage point, finishing at 2052, while the NASDAQ added 52, about 1%, ending at 4769 for the week, due in no small part to Fed meeting minutes. In related news, banking shares flew higher this week on increased rate hike expectations. The KBW NASDAQ Bank Index soared 4% as banks benefited from increased spreads between their loan fees and deposits. In addition, investors are clearly pleased by the hawkish Fed talk, indicating that officials are happy with the economic outlook. Technology stocks also led the S&P 500 higher on Friday, adding over 1%, while shares in Applied Materials, the chipmaker, soared 14% to 22.5%. After reporting Thursday, orders hit a 15-year high. Still, the S&P 500 earnings are on pace to decline about 7% for the year, according to Factsheet. Although market volatility is viewed in the CBOT VIX index is tame and the Fear and Greed index is somewhat neutral, the NASDAQ still is under support, and the Dow and the S&P 500 are in sort of a neutral territory as well. This is what I'd call the dead zone, where rallies can explode and then fizzle and vice versa. Not a lot of direction in the market. I expect to see stronger buying opportunities to unfold later this year. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Ralph Acampora, Prudential Securities and Knight Securities, published author, popular lecturer. It's just a pleasure to welcome back here to the show. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you, sir? Thanks for inviting me.
We've seen an increase in volatility, negative talk in the blogosphere. U.S. equities continue to hold up well, just meandering within a big consolidation. What do you see on a forward basis?
There's been some negative commentary, and I understand where the bears are coming from, because if you go back a year, the Dow and the S&P have been locked in a wide trading range. And every time they get up to their 2015 highs or close to them, they seem to churn. And that is concerning. But since the February low, February of this year, we've had a super move. It's been broad-based. It's been all-encompassing, even at commodities participating. So that was encouraging. However, I started to get a little concerned a couple of weeks ago when we started to lose the momentum of that February, March, April rally. So right now, I think if you look at, again, this is very technical, if you look at the Dow and the S&P, they're locked into a six-week trading range. On the downside, the Dow has supported around 17,484 and the S&P at around 2,033. So I think as long as we can stay above those levels, and obviously today we're bouncing off them, that's good. Okay? Honestly, Chris, I wouldn't want to see a break below those levels because then you'd be reversing that rally. And then the bears' argument that, hey, look at this, another failed rally, can't go through the 2015 high. And I can't argue with that.
If we look at the S&P 500, it has made a series of lower highs and lower lows, so has the NASDAQ, compared with the Dow Jones. You know, the Dow Jones 30 blue chips have not made new lows. There's a slight divergence.
I see where you're coming from, but that lower low in the S&P was, I think, part of the February bottom. I think it was a nice shakeout. So all total, we have to get out of this trading range one way or another. I'm still opting for an upside move eventually, yes, as long as the short-term lows hold, as I mentioned before.
Do you think that markets are hostage right here, at least partially, to the Fed policymakers' indecision over rates? I mean, clearly, they're not as sanguine on the economic prospects because they're afraid to pull the trigger again on higher rates.
That's part of it, and it's happened in the last few days. You've seen a stronger dollar. That's not good. And you've seen commentary about a weaker China economy, so that's not good either. So you have several factors. You have the Fed, you have the dollar, you have the Chinese economy, and I think you have to throw into the mix the presidential election cycle here. It's a toss-up, Democrat or Republican, so it'll be interesting. So there's reason for volatility, there's reason for this choppiness. I'm all for that. As long as we stay contained, we're okay.
U.S. Shares certainly benefited, I think, of the last few years, at least since the 2009 low, as a flight to quality, a flight to safety, a flight to performance, if you will, from Europe, as well as certain areas in Asia and around the globe. Do you see that trend after we get past these November elections likely reestablishing themselves as more confidence emerges from around the world? And obviously there's a changing of the guard in the U.S.?
That's a great question. I don't see it changing. Not totally convinced the emerging markets are out of the woods just yet because they've been underperforming basically since 2011. And, you know, they'll have periods where they do a little bit better than the U.S. market, but it doesn't seem sustainable. As far as Europe is concerned, I think they get past Brexit. I think they'll be okay. They'll recover.
And any comments on the precious metals sector? It's been a great year for equities amid a dollar slide, and as well as we've mentioned, lackluster numbers around the globe. Obviously, China, if their economic conditions are not as positive as expected or anticipated.
I have to say, I've been negative on gold for the past few years, but in the last 6-7 months, I've been pretty active and pretty positive on gold and silver. I think they made their bottoms, along with crude. So I tell you, any kind of weakness in gold, I'd probably be a buyer.
I'm glad you brought up crude. You know, this is a truly battered sector. Just did nothing, treaded water for almost 5 years after that 147 peak. The, you know, sub 30 per barrel, a compelling bottom. We've entered these sideways consolidations now for several years, and they always ended with further downside, lower lows. Any comments, any upside targets, perhaps?
I not only look at the commodity itself, I look at the underlying equities. Take big companies like Chevron and Exxon, and they look like pretty powerful moves. And they, to me anyway, technically, I think they have more to go. So I'm encouraged. I think any pullback, as I mentioned before, in crude, I think it'll be shallow. We would have a little pullback back to the low 40s in crude, light crude. I think you'd be making the right shoulder of a head and shoulder bottom. Be even more encouraging.
Any topicality that I've missed today?
No, I think you've covered it all. It's too easy to be bearish. And again, as I mentioned in the beginning, I've quite a few renowned technicians who are very, very negative. And I understand where they're coming from because they're taking a very long-term view, looking at the whole move from the 09 bottom and this massive churning that we've had for the last 12, 13 months, you know, since early 2015. Last time you and I have ever seen anything where it just churned for that period of time was in 2000, year 2000, when the bubble popped and the market went sideways for a year and then rolled over. And that's the bear argument. And my only argument to that is that we hold here, push to new highs. I think that negates their argument. So I still have my fingers crossed.
Ralph Eckenpohrer, we really appreciate your thoughts today. Any contact information or anything else you'd like to share with our listening audience? Peter Grandich has published commentary on the mining and metals sector for decades now. He's currently president of Peter Grandich and Company. Welcome back, Peter Grandich.
Thank you for always having me.
We just had Ralph Eckenpohrer on the show and had some interesting comments on the precious metals as well as the commodities that I think runs contrary to a lot of bears. He's convinced that the yellow metal and silver, as well as crude oil, have most likely found their bottoms. Now, there could be retests ahead, but he thinks the lows, the nadirs, are in place.
Well, I operate under the basis that the only one that really truly knows the future is God, but we can take good stabs at it. I think pretty much online, I don't see how oil goes back or even tests the mid-20s lows. I think we've had an absolute bottom, and I think the same could be said for gold. I know that this time last year, every day you all read somewhere somebody writing the death of gold, and it was going well under 1,000 and never get back above 1,000. And it managed to put in an incredible bottom. And I don't know, in 3+ decades of being around financial markets, I don't remember any market where it was just universal bearishness and basically last one out, turn out the light. So I think clearly both gold and oil have not only bottomed, I don't see any type of retest, anything close to those lows that were made in gold, you know, in the 1050 area, and in oil in the, you know, the mid-20s.
Exactly. I mean, it was a remarkable sell-off. I mean, take a look at the 147 zenith we saw 5 or 6 years ago, almost 5 years of sideways actions. And then it all just culminated with this dollar strength and broke down to, as you say, sub-30s. That seemed a bit extreme. It's good to hear that two top, you know, Wall Street pundits are on board, at least with us, that we could have seen the bottom. Do you like the shares, or are they overbought?
I think the shares are always a different story. They always tend to, when something has bottomed, they tend to move up far more percentage-wise. I think we've seen that both in the oil stocks, the metal stocks. If we look how much oil and gold percentage-wise is off its bottom, the shares are multiples higher than that. I think in the gold area, I think there's, while they've moved up a lot, I think if one has multiple year horizons and not just a day trader, there's still a lot of room in that. I mean, if people have to understand, and I was a victim of it too, of how devastation there's been from 2012 to this year in the metals and mining industry across a vast spectrum, not just metals, but base metals and steel and iron ore and all those things. And it's like battleships. They just don't turn on a dime. And I think people have been so badly beaten and bruised that even if they see the ship turning, they really won't jump back in until it's clear and evident that it's clear sailing again. So I think shares can consolidate at any period of time, but I think particularly in the metals, and they can move separately, historically at least, than what the general stock market does. I think if there was a big swoon in the general stock market, even if oil itself wasn't selling off because the oil stocks are so widely held, they could go down with that swoon. But I think I just don't know anybody who is really buying gold shares in the last few years. So I just think anybody that had to sell has done it. And that's why I think that there's still long-term, you know, there would be a substantial room on the upside. If you believe, as I do, that gold, you know, has a $1,400 or even $1,500 price before the end of the year in it.
We agree with you. $1,400, $1,500, we have our sights set on that target, 21 to 26, best case for silver. And we also share your thoughts on, you know, the XAU, down to lows not seen since maybe 2000, 2001. Give back all of the bull market, the 2001 to 2012 gold bull market, all of the gains that were recorded during that time, and maybe even went sub from the starting point briefly. That's virtually 100% retracement. I wonder if our listeners could imagine if the Dow Jones made a 100% retracement from the maybe 1929, 1931 low, the onset of the Great Depression. So excessive pessimism, certainly there. Just a normal retracement, a Fibonacci retracement, would take us higher. We haven't discussed the equities. We don't want to see a break of, you know, obviously support in the next few weeks. Otherwise, we'll have another retest of the lows we put in now and a couple of swings in the S&P and the Dow.
Well, I think the story that's not being widely discussed that's going to have a serious impact in the equity market is really the death blow to the hedge fund industry. I think there's clear evidence that the hedge fund model is not only under assault, but it's been, I believe, terminally damaged. And if that's true, and how much hedge funds have had in the past influence on the equity markets, I think that is a net negative for the general equity market. I will argue, in hindsight, it's always 20/20 to look back that. The most important thing that propelled the equity market the last few years higher is the Fed. The second most has been hedge funds and big money using a variety of programs, some of them only related to computer algorithms and couldn't even know what the name of the company is or what it does. But those things have helped propel the market higher. And I think they're in danger or have seen their best days. And so I would suspect that if you remove that power from the equation, I don't see how giving valuations are historically high.
You know, Ralph Acampora brought up here as well. He said, look, you know, we've got political issues, concerns about the economy. Obviously, the Fed is nervous because they're not willing to raise rates. If they're not raising rates, there's concerns there by our policymakers. And of course, that could indicate less than sanguine conditions ahead for the domestic economy. A lot of wild cards and investors, not big aficionados of wild cards. Tell us what else is on the docket. Anything else, any other topicality for our listeners, please?
What surprises me to this day in the last couple of years is how little attention has been paid to how the U.S. market in general, not specific to a core, is trading and acting as the Japanese market has done since 1989. The governments are making similar moves with monetary policies, the substandard economic growth. Once a powerhouse. When people ask me, what do you think the U.S. stock market or the U.S. markets in general are going to do? I tell them, look no further than what Japan has done. And now, as you hinted that, I think eventually the Fed resorts not only to not raising interest rates, but will be forced to some sort of QE4 or or worse, negative interest rates. I just think we've taken many of the actions that Japan has done, and we've seen how poorly it's worked for Japan. So I just think the United States is the sequel to Japan, in my honest estimate.
Stuck in the quagmire, not a lot of forward progress. We're likely to see some big volatility ahead and nervous investors. Certainly, you're paralleling a lot of the wiser minds on Wall Street and Main Street today. You're joining the chorus that maybe all is not as well as we think with the markets. And perhaps you'd like to share any contact information or more about petergrandich.com.
Your listeners are welcome to go to Peter Granich. That's Peter, G-R-A-N-D-I-C-H, one word, petergrandich.com. There's a Peter Speaks, that's our blog. They can just provide an email address and they can receive our comments.
Peter Granich, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Gold closed at a four-week high last week on geopolitical concerns, particularly in the Ukraine area. It's precious metals back on the radar screen, recapturing investors' attention. Who better to have on the show than the silver investor? David Morgan writes the Morgan Report, runs silverinvestor.com, will soon be republishing his book. Welcome, David Morgan.
Well, thank you, Chris. Great to be with you.
David, we're going to get more into this interesting book of yours at the end of the show, but I just kind of wanted to put that teaser out there, give people an idea. Any publishing dates come to mind in the next 6 months, 12 months?
It's called the deadline, and those are important. And, of course, we've never missed a deadline on the Morgan Report ever. I'm shooting to have a rough draft for the Money Show, which is in a couple of weeks, and that'll just be like a rough edit. It's like my third revision. But I really want to have it, you know, neat, tidy, and ready, you know, published by the Silver Summit this year, which is October, I think, 23rd, 2014. So say, you know, middle of October or so, we should have it done. So it's going to be a big, powerful, all-inclusive book this time, much more in-depth than Get the Skinny on Silver Investing, which the publisher had certain rules, you know, 100 pages, no graphs, no charts, all that. This we're self-publishing. And it'll have a lot in it, not only about the silver market, but basically the background, the why and the wherefores and the reasons behind the financial crisis or currency crisis that I and others have so long forecast. So that's a bit of a teaser as well, but I know you have a lot of questions to start with, so we should probably move on to those.
Well, I'm sure the gold and silver crowd will devour this upcoming edition with relish. We will give more juicy details out to the listeners at the end of the show. Let's get into
gold and silver. Gold still up about 5-6% for the year. Fantastic. Doing great. Silver still treading water, near the break-even level. Not so bad when you consider the volatility factor there. Why don't you tell folks about this disconnect we've seen recently? Maybe some gold premium with the geopolitical concerns in the Middle East, Ukraine, and of course the Argentina currency drama. I'm sure that's a big factor.
I think you touched on it, Chris. Basically, gold is much more mainstream, even though, you know, certainly not a Wall Street darling by any stretch of the imagination. But gold is almost presentable to most investors. I mean, it's known as a crisis hedge, as a safe haven. And those are respectable terms around the gold market. Silver is sort of the poor cousin of gold. It certainly is a safe haven. It does have a monetary status, but it also has an industrial quality. I'll never, you know, say anything different than that. So gold is more likely to move on geopolitical upheavals, et cetera, as you've stated. And I think that's why you're seeing more strength in the gold market than the silver market. The deal with silver is it's such a small market that it tends to move both directions faster than gold. So gold starts to get some real momentum here because of, let's call it, safe haven status or a risk-on trade. Silver will rapidly, that'll spill over to the silver market, and because it's cheaper and it's a market that, that especially fund managers, a lot of people like to move into rapidly. So it could all of a sudden outperform gold quite easily. So my take is what you said. We're going to see more and more gold money move into gold kind of slowly, hesitantly. I mean, really, if you think about it, fundamentally, there should be a pretty big move into gold right now with all that's going on geopolitically. But right now, there isn't relative to what the price action is. As far as what the physical movements are, they're hard to get an absolute accurate analysis on. Koos Jansen probably does as good as anybody. There's several analysts that do a good job. Obviously, tons of gold are moving into Asia. That's unabated. Although you have seen a couple of recent months come out where, you know, the gold trade is off, meaning substantially less imports for a month. I don't think a day makes a market, and I don't think a month makes a market. Overall, the move from gold from west to east continues. Regardless, I think it's going to take a gold move before you see silver. So that's my take on it right now. You know, August is historically the bottom month for gold. I just did an update for our members. There's a seasonality trade. Actually, in silver, that works about 80-85% of the time, August 15th through about March of the following year, just going along with the silver market. But I looked at gold this time, and I just, again, did the video for our members, and I do these videos for the Basic Plus service. And gold from the 6th, which we're behind that by, what, about a week, I guess, from the 6th of August up to about February of the following year, so February 2015, has about an 80-85% probability of making new money as well. And that trade I actually established on the 6th is already up, you know, a fair amount, enough to count your money. So I went ahead and for trading purposes, education purposes, said, okay, I'm going to go long at the market today, and it stopped just under the $1,300 level. So I'm going about a long way, winded way of saying that I really think the bottom is here. But I know there's a lot of others out there in my peer group that thinks that there's going to be another washout, or, you know, we're going to get clobbered, or the traders are showing this or that, and that type of thing. So you probably want to ask me something about that. I'm guessing, but that may be the case.
And I think there is a lot of pessimism. That's another big plus. When you talk about the propensity for silver to outperform gold, there's no better recent illustration than the 2010-2011 period, from, let's say, $15-$16 to nearly $50. We're talking a threefold, okay, 200%, but threefold. So let's say you had $10,000. At the peak, you had $30,000. We don't see that type of action in gold. Now, that's not to say we won't. Silver, if you'll recall, was one of the most boring markets for almost 2 years, from 2009 to 2010. People had just given up. Gold just kept running from 2008, 2009. It looked like it was going, never going to stop. And silver just sat there. I mean, it was one of the oddest disconnects. And, you know, we're starting to see a disconnect like that now. People are sick of it. They don't want want to hear about it. Think of the discount from $50 to $20. I mean, talk about a relative contrarian value.
Absolutely, Chris. I want to go back and say, you know, on that big run, you know, I established this intermediate level service I have called Basic Plus, and at the $19 level, I said if it broke through, I'm going long. And I rode that to 26, got out and got right back in, rode all the way to 48 and got out within about 3 or 4 days to the top. So I actually had a couple of people that are in the field, so to speak. One is, you know, I won't even say anymore because I don't want people guessing who it was, but this guy retired. I mean, that one trade. Now, I'm not suggesting anyone trade futures. In fact, I actually suggest most people stay as far away from it as they possibly can. But what it does illustrate that if you know what you're doing and you want to put on a position trade and ride it all the way up, it can make up for a lot of mistakes. That was something that we did. You know, I wish I could say we do that every year or on and on. But what I can say is that was established as a remarkable move, as you said, and it's backing you up. And, you know, I was really concerned with everyone, public and private, meaning people that are members of the website, and anyone out there that's involved in the silver market, because there was so much enthusiasm. And anything around a 35 level on up, I was highly suggesting in the public domain to, you know, be careful. If you have to buy silver, don't buy it all, you know, just buy some and that type of thing. Yet, you know, I just got a letter, an email recently about, you know, I'm sick of this. I bought all my silver at 40. Now I understand everything there is to know about silver. It's never, ever going to go above 20. And, you know, prove to me why I'm wrong, Mr. Expert. You know, and I actually did send him a private message, and I did say, basically I said, read my book, but I gave him some other tidbits. And, you know, not that I am the end-all, be-all in the silver market. I certainly have put my time and dues into this market, continue to do so. And I use the silver guru moniker is kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. It's something to remember me by, and I just picked it as a name I could get people to, you know, come to the Hotmail account. When I started, I didn't even have a website. I just had the Hotmail address. But anyway, back on point, it will do that again. And people, there'll be more silver purchase, Chris, above $35 an ounce than there was between this $20 and $35 level. People will not buy bottoms, and it really drives me crazy. I try to find out and ask myself, what can I do differently? What can I say differently? What can I publish? What can, you know, and it's crazy because you look at, you know, people that, let's say, I'll just say it as I see it, that complain, and they complain about, you know, why this or that happens and why the rich get richer and that kind of thing. And it's funny because you look at who bought silver at a bottom. It was Warren Buffett, bought it at the all-time inflation-adjusted low. George Soros, who I'm no big fan of, but he had a major interest in Apex Silver Mines, which is now defunct. And Bill Gates bought a rather substantial position. For him, it was probably just a little drop in the bucket. And he was using one of probably several fund managers that he associates with to put a nice big fat chunk into Pan American Silver. So the billionaires, not the millionaires, the billionaires are buying silver at the bottom. Well, this, as far as I'm concerned, is another bottom. Now, it could go lower, could get a spike low, we could see, you know, something breached. I'll go on. I'll say, I won't give the name, but talk to a PhD, very bright guy. I had about a two-hour conversation with him, and you got to keep my interest for me to talk to anybody that long. But he'd done some algorithms, and he's pretty convinced that there's going to be a spike low in silver. Gold's going to kind of hold, and the ratio is going to get back to 80 to 1. For the record, I doubt it. But I'm not going to say he's wrong. I'm way too smart, way too seasoned, and the silver market can surprise even me to say that's not, you know, not going to happen. I don't think it will. I really don't. I think the probability of that is probably less than 15%. So for the record, that's where I'm standing. Will it happen? I doubt it. Is it impossible to happen? No. Probability is very low. However, if that were to happen, if you had any guts, and it takes guts in the silver market, you'd certainly want to load the boat because those type of spike lows, and I've seen them over and over again. In fact, I wrote an article in Futures Magazine called Spiked, and it was all about these spike lows in the silver market. That's when you want to get on. Problem is, most people can't because it's a one-day or hourly event. Unless you're sitting there at a computer watching it, the chance of getting in are almost impossible. So you'll see a spike low, and then it'll come up and close much higher that same day. But anyway, I think I said enough on the topic. The best thing for most people is take a long-term view. Don't try to buy the bottom. Don't look for the spike low. Just keep buying at a certain range, and certainly a good range right now. You know, once you get, if you accumulated what you want, say 10% of your overall portfolio by the time, you know, such and such a time, or by the time silver's under 25, I think if you've got a 2, 3, 4 year time horizon, you're going to be very happy you did such.
I think it's an excellent strategy. You know, this idea that you have to catch the absolute bottom, that's the most expensive trade you'll ever make. You know, the tops and the bottom, more money's lost, I think, at those points than anywhere else. And I thought it was interesting that you say that investors simply can't buy bottoms. You know, you'd think that's where the interest would come in, but they lose enthusiasm. It really requires the bull trend, I think, to pull in people where the excitement starts to build in these markets. My guess is you're keeping an eye on, well, there's several factors going on. I mean, other than geopolitical, is there anything else that you'd like to hone in on here?
Looking at, you know, the new uses of silver, which always continue, and one of them is the solid-state lighting. So this is going to be a chapter in the book, not just solid-state lighting. The chapter will be about new uses in silver and where we see the future of silver on the industrial side. And there's also silver batteries, which, you know, this is not really a forecast, but something to pay attention to. And this is, you know, the electric car. I think the electric car is here to stay. I'm a good friend of Mike Maloney's, as you probably know, and have the fun of driving Mike's Tesla. Last time I was visiting him in Los Angeles, and those things accelerate. Wow. But my point is, these lithium-ion batteries that Tesla's manufacturing and others for these electric cars, there is a silver substitute. And I think at some point you may see silver lead or silver zinc or silver something battery that may be better than a lithium-ion, as far as better meaning, you know, longer range, more capacity, that type of thing. As far as weight, I'm not too sure. It'd probably be heavier, but not necessarily, you know, for the amount of juice getting out. Nothing conducts electricity as well as silver. And, of course, all of it's recyclable. In other words, the lithium ions are recyclable batteries, and silver would obviously be recyclable as well. So there's a lot of potential uses for silver that aren't, you know, right in your face at this point in time, but they're out there kind of lurking around, if you will. And some of them are very significant, such as what I mentioned, although may never come to fruition. It's possible it could. So we address that in the chapter. And, of course, the other things we're looking at is what investor sentiment is. And sentiment is what we just spent most of the show on. You know, when no one wants it, that's when you want it. When everybody wants it, that's when you don't want it. And that's going to be, I think, the hardest thing for me is 3 or 4 years from now, 2016 or 17, that's my current forecast, when everybody and his brother's calling me and saying, you know, I want to get your subscription. Dealer has silver. I can't find it here in Ohio. I can't find it in Florida. And, you know, that type of thing. And it's like, I don't look at it. Is it overvalued or not? Even silver can be overvalued. And it's not how many paper dollars silver's worth. It's how much does silver buy relative to other commodities. It's really the way to look at it. And when it's overvalued, I'm going to say, you know what? It's overvalued. I'm not afraid to pull the gun. In fact, one of the chapters in the book is about how to exit the market. We've had, I think it's like 5 or 6 strategies on how to exit the market. And, you know, it's investing is really about buying right. Selling isn't really an issue if you buy right. Of course, a lot of people will hold too far because they think it's going to go to the moon, and nothing, even the silver market, doesn't go to the moon.
David Morgan, I know there's listeners scratching their heads saying the silver investor is better connected than I am, has been in this industry for decades. Give us some sentiment indications. Let's say the silver ETF ownership and holdings. Interest levels very low there. What else are you looking at to kind of give you a gauge, a metric, to know that people have just tossed in the towel?
I'd say ETFs is a good place because these are the big purchasers. We look at, you know, the real silver bulls for the last decade or so. You look at the Sprott Physical Silver Trust. You look at Central Fund of Canada. You look at Zurich Continental Bank. You look at the SLV. You will find that there's no new purchases there. And there's several reasons for it. So The main reason is low prices. Now, that contradicts what I just said. Most of these guys are savvy enough to buy low. The problem is these are funds, and for them to buy low, they have to have a premium in the fund. And for most of them, there isn't enough of a premium to go ahead and float an offering to get enough money to go out and buy physical silver. So for them, it's sort of a catch-22. So that's one of those things that I'm looking at. We just get up off the bottom here. I think that you may see one come, and it's a little bit of a copycat industry, meaning that if you see one of those major funds or holding companies come in and make a substantial silver purchase, I wouldn't be surprised to see a couple more come in shortly thereafter, meaning within 2, 3, 4 months, and also make it. And if there were substantial purchases, like we've seen in the past, you have 20 million ounces here, 30 million ounces there, that type of thing, all of a sudden you might see a little bit more momentum in the silver market. And there's a shelf filing on most of these things. So these shelf filings are already filed with the SEC that basically says anytime they want to float an offering, it will. They'll put it out in the public domain, and you'll know about it about as quick as me. And then if I get whispered the number, let's say I have a call with John Emery, which I talk to John on a fairly regular basis, you know, I'm not allowed at law to tell even my members early. You know, I have to wait for it to be public information. So that's something that I can't really do. But no, I look more sentiment to me kind of goes with the market. I'm not a pure technician nor a pure fundamentalist. But if all of a sudden you start to see a lot of money moving in the silver market for no apparent reason, usually that means somebody knows something that perhaps even I don't. And if I saw that, obviously I'd get on the phone and start calling calls, and I might find out. In fact, in most cases, probably 80% of the time I would. But again, it was like Zurich Continental Bank and Eric Mayer over there was buying. He might even tell me, but I'm not allowed to say that until it becomes public domain knowledge. So that would be a situation that, you know, by being a member, you really wouldn't have a super advantage on.
Fundamentals obviously haven't really changed much, have they, over the past decade? I mean, sure, we had a sell-off from 2011 through 2013. But if gold went to a new nominal high in 2011, why is it that silver didn't run to a new nominal high? And should we be discouraged by that fact, or should we be now encouraged by it that it is inevitable, could represent, at least on a inflation-adjusted level, an interesting target to shoot for in the years to come?
First of all, the last decade, fundamentally, silver was about 35% of the market was for industrial use 10 years ago. Now it's about 55%. So industrial usage over the last decade has actually increased significantly. And again, we go into that in the book. Secondly, one of the things that's really important for people to know, and it seems to be misread by many silver aficionados, and that is that the production of silver increased during that same 10-year time frame. And it's like any commodity or anything in the market that's wanted badly. There's something that's wanted there, and the price is going to be profitable. There's going to be that demand that's going to drive up the supply. So the supply of silver rose significantly in the same 10-year time frame. Why didn't it make a nominal new high? Well, no one knows the answer to that, really. We did get to the nominal, you know, 50-ish level. But again, that's a nominal price. 50 today certainly is not much less valuable than 50 back in 1980. However, I think it has to do a lot with what goes on in this market, how much momentum there was. I mean, they put five margin upgrades or increases in margin, I should say, while it was going up. The market was going parabolic. There's a lot of reasons on both arguments on why it was done. So there was lots of, let's say, impetus to keep the market around that level or lower. And of course, it was successful. So I don't look at it as, I got that question very much at that time frame. But it's over when it's over. And it's not over. In fact, I'll be speaking in about a week at the Money Show in San Francisco. And the title of my speech will be, Precious Metals the Next 3 Years. Yeah, I'm not a big Elliott Wave guy, but I've studied markets my whole life. And basically, there's three moves up for any major market. And we've had two, and we've got one to go. And the last one is usually the one, the big one, the one that people like, if you're old enough to remember what Intel stock looked like in its heyday. I mean, it just keeps going up and up and up, and no one wants to get off. And this is what's going to happen, in my view, in the precious metals. But I'm not looking for that kind of move until 2016. But when it happens, there'll be more and more and more people coming in. But then there'll be that last buyer, and there will be no one to sell to, like all markets, like the technology boom, like the real estate bubble. And I think it'll be the bubble of all bubbles. I think it'll be compounded because of the synergistic effect. I think you're going to see the metals being held strongly in strong hands and added to by weaker hands come in the market. And at the same time, you're going to be having a semi or total debt crisis. So as people want out of bond markets, and this is across the board, not only government bonds, but municipal bonds, junk bonds, corporate bonds, there's going to be a lot of worry about what debt's good and what debt isn't. And they'll be seeking safe haven status, and that means gold primarily, but silver will be the spillover market. It's so tiny, and silver is priced less than gold. It'll push silver to new highs in real terms. So that's what I'm looking for, Chris. I'm not that concerned about it. You know, I said it would happen in my lifetime. It's still going to be a bit of a grind here. You know, it's not going to be happy days are here again, in my view, until sometime probably the latter part of 2015. But you can make a lot of money being a prudent fundamental investor at this point in time while we're doing your show, averaging in now, and just having a long-range view, meaning a long-range nowadays is, you know, 3 to 5 years. So, again, I think this is the time. Nobody wants it. You should want it.
I think it's well said. And, you know, where are the alternatives? I was, you know, talking to Bill Murphy last week and other guests recently. I mean, the way that the interest rates are set up, retirees, young folks, we're all in the same boat together, aren't we? I mean, there's just nowhere to hide. You can't beat inflation with almost any investment today. You know, you have this opportunity to get at gold and particularly silver, vastly discounted prices, and you can't park your wealth capital almost anywhere else to compensate for inflation better than precious metals. I think you've done a good job outlining some of the highlights that we should expect. Maybe you'd like to tell folks more about the Morgan Report.
If you want free information, you can go to our website, themorganreport.com. There's a free e-letter that comes out every Saturday. You can get that for free. If you're more inclined to get money, metals, and mining, over on the right-hand side, subscribe to our 3 levels of service. Also, for freebies, there is a YouTube channel called Silver Guru and a Twitter feed at Silver Guru.
You did kind of allude to 2016. I wonder if you could just add a few details here, give us an idea of what's so special, according to your work, about this time frame. I mean, is this political? Is this the changing of the guard? Or is there something else that you're seeing? Is it cyclical? Do you see a cycle top coming in when you add in the Elliott wave analysis?
The Elliott wave again. I'm not a big fan of the Elliott wave theory, but no, it's more or less educated guess, knowing how markets move. This last leg up, once it gets going, it goes parabolic and stays there for probably months. And if you take a look at what the NASDAQ did, you get a pretty good idea of what I expect in the metals, or even the housing index during the rise up into 2007. Again, you'll get a pretty good idea of what I expect. The commodity cycle is usually a 17-year cycle average. So if you take 2000 for gold and add 17, you come out with 2017. A friend of mine wrote a book that got out an award called Polar Perspectives. And in that book, I think his date was in 2017. I didn't go along, you know, I'm saying that he agrees with me or I agree with him, but, that's my best wag right now. And I'll just call it a wag. But, normally when you get the spike high that we got, from the 1948 we discussed on your show, it usually takes at least 2 years, usually three, to consolidate. We've been a little longer than 3 years. Consolidation should be nearing an end. And then it takes a good year or so to come back up into the range where it was getting frothy, which pick a number, 35, 40, I don't know. So looking a year out, we'd put you in 2015 in the summer. Maybe it'll be in the 40 range. Maybe in the 50. And of course, I have to put in a caveat I always do, Chris, which is that, you know, barring some huge geopolitical event, which could send the metals up, you know, instantly overnight, but barring that taking place, that's what I expect.
All right, David Morgan, we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Well, thank you, Chris.
He Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There is a common misunderstanding that many people have about how business and politics operates in America. When media reports that a certain business or business person donated X number of dollars to a certain political candidate at some point in time, the impression is created that that person or business entity actually supported the policies or beliefs of that particular candidate when that financial support was pledged. The odds of that being true are probably less than 50-50, because business is ultimately very pragmatic. The fact is, it is a common practice of businesses and law firms, for example, to donate, often equally, to both political candidates in a race, because those firms, those businesses, need to transact business, no matter who wins. It's their way of being bipartisan, not political. Because regardless of who wins, they will need to get business done, and may need access, at some point, to at least get their point of view heard without interruption. Don't get me wrong. There are many individuals and businesses who are very partisan in their approach to politics and political donations. But politicians come and go, and the machinations of government that operate behind the scenes stay from administration to administration at all levels of government, regardless of what political party is temporarily in charge. This is just as true on the county level, as it is on the state level, as it is on the federal level. I recall speaking to a large trade organization. I was scheduled to be the closing speaker at the general session just after the buffet breakfast. That group's lobbyist actually spoke at the breakfast before my presentation. It was a short talk, but had a profound impact on the audience and on me. For context, it was early in an election year just like now. His lobbying firm was renewing their contract for the upcoming year, and like each year before, he gave an elevator speech about the importance of what their firm accomplished for this trade organization and how they protected them. The trade organization was knee-deep in their political action committee and assigning members to help with those efforts. This lobbyist stood before them and basically said all those efforts, all the funds raised for PACs, all the time they were going to volunteer for their candidate, while noble, would ultimately have little impact on how the system worked for their trade organization. He said congressional and state politicians ultimately make only a fraction of the laws and rules and regulations that go into effect each and every year. He said the real power rests with the infrastructure of the system itself. The individuals that run our government at all management levels in all departments, from administration to administration, their departments create the majority of the rules and regulations that impact our lives and our businesses. His elevator speech explained that his job was to know and understand who these people are. So when a problem came up, solving that problem was based not just on expertise, but on years of personal relationships. He said the elections mattered maybe 5%, and the behind-the-scenes machinations mattered 95%. It reminded me of the auto mechanic who took 5 minutes and popped a bolt onto the engine of a person's car who happened to be stranded out of town and said, "That will be $50. The customer responded, "$50 for a bolt?" The mechanic said, "It's a dollar for the bolt, but it's $49 to know where the bolt goes." Expertise is always worth a premium. The lobbyist got his firm's contract renewed, as he had done every year for the past decade. But the lessons he shared about understanding where the real power is, was, and always has been within the system was an important eye-opener. He delivered that little breakfast speech in 1996. A lot has changed since then, but a lot has also remained the same. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.